Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of From the Roots Up. I'm your host, Sean Frame, back with another episode filled with interesting information, things that affect our lives. This week's topic is a broad one. It's a big one. It's one that we hear about more and more every day. You can't watch the news, read the news, be on the internet, or even just, you know, try and search for something on the internet without engaging this topic. And I'm talking, of course, about AI. Whether you've just noticed the change in your web-based search engines, you know, and how they function, or whether you've immersed yourself in some of the powerful new tools like ChatGPT, which is a large language model, or generative AI tools like Midjourney, you're probably somewhat aware of this powerful technology. And since the topic is so large, I called upon a longtime friend and ancient radio collaborator, somebody I actually was on the radio with back in the 80s. But he's now an expert on the subject of AI. His name is Dr. John P. Sullins III, professor of philosophy and computer science at Sonoma State University. He's written a book about it and has been really going after this topic since the days when AI was really, well, either completely different or not even imagined the way it is today. So he's sort of been there going all the way back to the ground level. We'll hear a little bit about his background, and then we're going to talk a lot about the subject. And because John is a world-renowned expert, and because the topic is so broad, I have allocated most of my show this week to our conversation. So I hope you'll join us on this journey right here on From the Roots Up. This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento or online at torchclub.net. We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. Welcome back to From the Roots Up. Today, I've got John P. Sullins III. I'll just say John because John and I go way back. And and John is a professor of philosophy and computer science at Sonoma State University. And welcome, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Sean. Super looking forward to it. It's been a while since we've been on the radio together.
It has been quite a while, and I think it's amazing that we're back after all these years talking about something that neither of us could have imagined at the time.
Our barely, topic today. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just saying, like, this was the stuff of science fiction, but our topic today is actually the stuff of reality. And I'm hoping to talk with you today about AI, about computer learning, and just how that, you know, the ethics of it, I think, is a super interesting part of it, which I know is a big part of what you have focused on. And let's get into it. First of all, like, how did you go from being my, you know, a guy on the radio with me at San Jose State University way back when in the 80s, to somebody who is now a philosophy professor focused on robotics and AI and all these issues?
Yeah, well, I think it has a lot to do with the forward-thinking philosophy department at San Jose State University. So, you know, both you and I had to take general education classes and various things to get our degree. And one of the things that I got into was a class called Philosophy and Technology. It was run by Professor Scott Noam Cook. And I really did great in that class. I wound up getting an A, and then I just decided to be an assistant for him and help him teach. He had like 5-6 sections of that class going all the time. And so I helped for a couple of years, and then he asked me to be a research assistant with him. I switched my major over to philosophy as a master's degree. because I got really interested in this topic, particularly as it relates to high technology and all of that, which even back then was, you know, it was interesting. That was the days of knowledge bases, and we were doing it a different kind of a different style of AI. It would turn out to not be quite as exciting as this particular new version of AI, but it was exciting enough. And so while I was getting my master's degree, he invited me to be his research assistant at Xerox Palo Alto Research Laboratory, the famous place where they invented the computer mouse and the GUI interface and Ethernet and everything that it takes to make the computer what it is today was all invented up there, and then promptly sold by Xerox rather than capitalized on.
Which is an interesting story unto itself.
We should do a show on that one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly an interesting part of the technological advancements. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people out in our listening audience, you know, have some vague notion of what AI is. They may have used some of the tools that are readily available online or even in some basic software applications. I mean, a lot of AI is now being built into some of the most basic tools that folks use every day, you know, whether it's, you know, word processing applications or spreadsheets or email applications. But really, I mean, how do you define the current sort of generation of AI, right? Like, what would be the defining characteristics of that? So when somebody encounters it, they go, oh, okay, I see this thing, and now I understand that that's something, there's this thing happening in the background called AI. Mm-hmm.
Right. There's so much now, and AI is a term that refers to quite a number of different specific technologies, and they can be pretty non-exciting from somebody's outsider standpoint, and they can be extremely mystifying in other cases. I think what is greatly different now is the fact that we use machine learning techniques that are based on essentially, you know, artificial neural nets and different, you know, there's hundreds of different versions of those and ways of constructing them and programming them. But for instance, back when you and I were in college, that idea was out there, but it was not a favored idea. It was a background idea, and one that was that had promise, but it wasn't the way that AI was done. Today, that has changed largely through the great success of being able to feed these machines the vast amounts of data that they need and power these machines the way that they needed to be powered. And when neural nets were first discovered, they were just very small and not super capable. And really what it took to make AI work was 20 years of us providing free labor. So I remember when I was in graduate school 20 plus years ago, there was a job that you could get. You could get a job typing facts into a computer so that the computer would know things like, you know, when Joe uses a razor to shave his face, the razor isn't part of his arm, right? So just like these very common sense things that, you know, if you think about the world from a computer's point of view, how do they know? They don't know any of this stuff, right? We do,
right?
And yeah, if we want to interact with it in a meaningful way, it's got to know the world the way we know the world. And it's this kind of alien thing that doesn't have that kind of contact with the world. So, you know, you could do that. And that was a thing. But it turned out that you just couldn't hire enough graduate students. There was no way to get enough money to type fast enough all the facts that a machine needed to know. But then along comes the internet, and then along comes all the rest of us typing away furiously all day, every day, literally billions of inputs. And that data is, in many cases, was collected, and different databases were formed. And you could then take these kind of crude artificial neural networks and start giving them the data that they were starved for. And they work off of basically statistical analysis. So that now it knows that a razor isn't part of the person's hand, not because it knows that, right? The AI does not know that. But what it does know is that almost all the writing that is out there that has ever been written talks about razors not being part of people's hands, right? Being separate from something that person picks up and puts away. So now the machine can talk credibly about holding and using a razor for the most part. When it makes a mistake, it can't know that it made a mistake. It's making a statistical analysis. And that means that it's not going to be a guaranteed answer, but it's going to be right nearly all of the time. And that's something that I think is hugely different. You know, when we were younger and AI was just kind of a dream, you know, it started 40s and 50s, right, was when people started realizing that machines might be able to do things that were quite similar to human intelligence. Back then, they were using them as logic proof machines, you know, provers of mathematical proofs, geometric proofs, that kind of stuff. And they were using full kind of deductive logic so that if you put in good facts, you would get true things out of the end of the machine. So right. we had this myth that, you know, computers couldn't lie, for instance, or that right. You know, everything they said was true. And we can rattle off, you know, 18 different movies and books that treated machines that way, right? And fed us that.
Right. And it got us to the moon. So
exactly.
I mean, you also had very specific examples of how not only was it not wrong, but you could count on people's lives could depend on that machine's ability to calculate things to the degree that we could send somebody to the moon and bring them back. Right.
Absolutely. Like, with a pretty not exciting machine. Right. I mean, something that was far less powerful than what you have in your pocket. Right.
From the Roots Up is community radio that is sponsored by community businesses. If you'd like to join the growing list of folks who make this show possible, reach out to Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, at khi.com. From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Six Pack. Crack open some change and support the candidates and causes we need in these times. Paid for by The Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Sitting there watching as it bleeds. First of all, it's like, let's teach the computer things, but then that's just so slow, right? And so manual. And so, like, it would have taken an infinite amount of time to get anywhere close to where we are.
Exactly.
Now, the internet comes out, as you said, we're all typing away. We're also creating images. We're sharing sound. We're sharing video. We're sharing, you know, pictures, photographs. Mm-hmm. All of this data is out there. And the machines are learning from it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all sounds like, okay, that's pretty, you know, not a lot to that. But then at some point the machine is asked to spit it back out, and words are kind of hard, right? Like, unless it spits out an exact replica of a novel that was, you know, put typed at one point and put on the internet. It would be very difficult to know whether your words or my words or anybody else's words were the exact words, unless it cites a source, and in which case, at least it's citing the source it got it from. But when you get into things like images and music and video and some of the artists, you know, who looked at some of the early examples of images being created, were like, wait a minute, like, that looks startlingly like something that I created. It feels like you just plagiarized me.
Right.
What happens then? Like, did we all just agree that when we were using the internet, like, I guess we just gave up any rights to any of our creations? Or, you know, where are we with that? I think that's, it's an ethical question. I think it's certainly a concern of a lot of people, especially creative folks. You know, how is that being navigated now that we kind of understand that, oh, anything we ever put on the internet is now part of this database and might come back randomly, just exactly the way we created it.
That's right. Yeah. So, so when you think of, you know, what does GPT stand for? It's a generative pre-trained transformer. There's a lot in those words, right? So the first most important one is the generative one. That means that this machine doesn't just go, like you ask it a question, it doesn't just go out and find the answer fully formed somewhere and then bring it back to you. That's what a Google search does, right? What a generative machine does is it's going to take information, just as you said, and it's going to do something with it, right? And so, what's it going to do? That's what the next two letters tell us. So it's going to be pre-trained on this data, just like you said, and then it's going to transform that data into something new, and it can transform it into literally infinite number of different things. So if I want to say, you know, draw me a picture of Abraham Lincoln in the form style of Maxfield Parrish, it's going to do a pretty great job at that. And it'll give me many, many different examples, and I can choose the one that I think best suits what I'm after. In the case of Maxfield Parrish, I mean, all that stuff's probably close to not copyright anymore. I think, you know, it's a little over 100 years with that stuff. You know, that's probably not going to be a big affront to anyone, but if we do it in the style of a more contemporary artist, then you know, like remember the Studio Ghibli photo filter that was popular recently? You can take any particular image and you can make it look as if it came out of, you know, My Neighbor Totoro or any of the other popular films from that studio. So is that a copyright infringement? You know, they didn't draw any of this. This isn't taken from any film. This is just in the style of those films. So do they own that particular way of drawing people or thinking about the world? This is a really new question. Are you challenging a copyright? I think you definitely are when you use one of their characters, right? You put one of their into something else, then you are challenging their copyright. But what if you're just challenging their copyright by the way you draw your background? And you're the character, right? Because you're doing it on your Instagram film.
Right.
So it's just you, as if you were in the My Neighbor Totoro world. Is that a copyright infringement? You know, that's something we haven't had to deal with in the past. We are definitely going to. It reminds me of a lot of Andy Warhol, right? Andy Warhol saw this coming, and
for sure,
and challenged us with his art, which was, you know, was it theft? Was it you know, what's he doing? He's just basically copying, you know, stuff.
A Campbell's soup can. Yeah.
Yeah. Just putting a different kind of flavor to it. Right. And a different kind of coloration to it. So those ideas that he was playing with in a artistic sort of way are now the reality of art. Right. He was right. He was right. That's where art was headed. Whether we like it or not.
Now, you know, there are whole, I mean, they call it AI slop because they're just whole channels filled to the brim with all kinds of AI generated content mm-hmm. that is there just to draw eyeballs and generate ad revenue. So mm-hmm. it's another step further. Like if I just put it on my, you know, Facebook or Instagram or whatever, you know, I decide that I'm going to be in Totoro on my my LinkedIn page because I just think that'd be fantastic. That's one thing. I'm not necessarily monetizing that, but mm-hmm. I am definitely stealing that style from the artist who created it. So another thing entirely when you're out monetizing it, right? Like I think that's another level up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And a lot of what we're seeing the AI slop is it's just good enough to get you to possibly cast your eyes across it for a few moments and then maybe click one of those advertisements up in the, you know, the bar to the side. And that seems to be enough to make a reasonable amount of money for people so that they create these bots that create all this garbage. And that's what you see, you know, like if you ask AI to tell you, you know, hints on using makeup, I guarantee you that 90% of everything that you get off of the internet will just be constructed by robots who've never applied makeup ever. Right. They're just stealing from various channels of people that do that. And blogs and different things that have been written over the years and repackaging it into something that's just slightly different than the original, but not exactly the same. So it's not really a copyright infringement. It's some kind of new infringement that the law has not really caught up to yet.
If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go. The Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club. There's always something happening.
What do you see as the top ethical concerns that we should all be thinking about right now and probably aren't being brought to us by the AI journalists who are now writing many of the articles we read?
These technologies give us the ability to access information. They give us the ability to greatly extend the way we communicate information. And the most important one, I think, today is they give us the ability to synthesize information, meaning I can create new information that wasn't there before I accessed the database. So that's the part I think that's each of those three things are have their own issues, like with access, who gets paid, when, where, and why for the information that we get. Stuart Brand once said that you know, information has two aspects to it. In one sense, it wants to be free because the technologies that we create are so capable of just getting information into everybody's hand. There's really no physical barriers to do so. But on the other hand, it wants to be expensive, meaning it's hard to create, right? It takes an artist large chunks of their life to develop a style and to make that something that people want to see and hear or participate in. And that labor doesn't come for free, right? So those people need to be compensated for that. But unfortunately, like if you're Beyonce, right, you can put a lot of money and time and effort into your new album, and somebody can steal it just as they did. And as soon as it gets out, it's out, you know, and there's no putting that genie back in the bottle. AI, unfortunately, makes it so easy for everyone to become, plagiarizing pirates.
Yeah.
And it becomes so commonplace that we don't even notice it, right, as plagiarism or piracy, right?
Yeah, I was going to say it makes some of the older piracy look very quaint.
But yes, exactly.
Because it's not just piracy, it's novel piracy, right? Like you could be just this far different and also a novel thing, but also does that cheapen, you know, the art that you spend all this time creating? And I feel right. like maybe it does. I don't know. It's definitely a question of, you know. And so there is this, so you mentioned, and you're kind of alluding to this notion of like displacement. And I don't mean like our robot overlords make us their slaves. Like let's at least hope that's not where it's going. That's not where we're going to end this interview today, John, where you tell me that that's where we're headed. But, what I do wonder though is like there is going to be a lot of displacement, right? Like as somebody who makes my my career is design and writing and video, it does concern me that I might be the last generation of people to actually make a living in these arts, and journalists probably feel the same way, and photographers, and And many other professions, by the way. Many would argue lawyers should feel very, very, very worried about their professional standing because of the same thing, right? Like it's much of what they do is assimilate lots of information and come up with novel ways to apply it to cases, right? So there's a lot of professions where there could be displacement. How do we handle this? How do we tackle these challenges?
Yeah, I think what's super fascinating about the world we live in is it would have been hard to guess that machines would be coming after the creative people first. That if you had asked me, 10 years ago about this, I would have said, well, you should try to get a job, be a creative person, because machines aren't very creative, and that is probably where the least amount of automation would occur. But wow, that was wrong. It turns out that generative AI can generate a lot of stuff, and the vast majority of it is garbage, but because it can do it so fast and produce so many things, some of it actually turns out to be, good or useful. So this brings up this kind of troubling philosophical question, which is, is that really all that creativity is? Is creativity just some kind of statistical anomaly? And it turns out that there isn't, the spark of genius and creativity are some ineffable something that comes to us through our soul or whatever, right? All the stories that we've heard about great art in the past have always relied on some kind of spark of genius, right? That is what creates, what separates a creative, super creative person from the rest of us. And when you look at just some programming that you use to run a generative AI, like you can't point to the spark of creativity. It's not a line in the code. It's just something that comes out of the interaction of statistics and truly massive amounts of data and pushing around unbelievably large numbers of electrons and paying the cost for that, right, in heat and loss of water to do so. If you're willing to do that, then you can make a pretty credible, almost Totoro.
We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Is the demand of energy from AI going to become a real challenge? I mean, I've seen companies like Google and Amazon roll back their climate initiatives that they committed to not that long ago, maybe a decade ago, because they recognized that the need for energy for AI of all kinds, particularly generative AI, is going to make increase the demand beyond what you could do renewably, right? With what's available right now, anyway.
Well, for many years, right, we believed that, you know, computers would always be twice as good and half as expensive as they were the generation before.
And Moore's Law,
Moore's Law, which was everybody was thinking that way. And therefore, the tech companies were patting themselves on the back because, of course, their machines are going to get smaller and more capable and less, you know, require less power and all of that. So that they felt that they had a good chance of leading the climate change initiatives. And that changed really remarkably, as you say, just in the last 3-4 years. All of those benchmarks that they had for meeting climate goals, they just threw those out the window as fast as possible. And instead, they are greedily looking around for every ounce of electricity and building more and more data centers, bigger and bigger data centers. So these computers are getting bigger. They're not getting smaller. And well, they're getting smaller and bigger at the same time. That's what's really interesting. So the space that they take up and the power that they take up is increasing. But of course, each few months or so, the machines get faster and better as well. But we are outstripping the down curve of requirements that the machine needs by expanding the number of machines that we are feeding. And so that gets a net positive, unfortunately, for the amount of energy that we need. And it just keeps growing and growing. To the point where companies like Microsoft are looking at reopening nuclear power plants that were shut down. People are
Three Mile Island, right?
Yeah, like
part of
people are trying to reopen Three Mile Island. I mean, would you have ever thought you would say those words, right? And yet it's going, you know, it's very likely to happen. So a super power hungry way of producing knowledge, that was hard to see coming. And that is going to be something that when you ask what's one of the biggest ethical concerns, I believe that's it, right? What if maybe we could cure cancer with AI? Would it be worth burning down the rainforest for? That I think is an ethical question.
Yeah, and it comes dangerously close to one of the most dystopian things I ever heard anybody say about AI. It might have been a year or two ago, and I don't remember where I heard the interview, but the person talking said, well, they said, well, like, what's your nightmare scenario? And said the nightmare scenario is that the AI system wakes up and realizes that we are an impediment to it getting the power it needs. And it's therefore going to shut off the grid to us because it will be in control of the grid.
Yes.
And make sure that all the power is routed to the AI systems, right? Because human beings, we need air conditioning. We have very specific climate requirements to live. And whereas AI, you know, has a much sort of narrower need, and it's just more and more power and cooling, right? It's like those two things. And so
absolutely
what you just said is dangerously close to that, right? Like, would you cure cancer, but also at the same time burn down the rainforest to do it?
Yeah.
Like, that's a real question that we might have to ask ourselves, right? It's not like a hypothetical. That you could fill in the blank with different things, right? Like, instead of cure cancer, it might be something else. We could have life on Mars,
right?
Except that, you know, and on, right? Fill in the positive net benefit, and the other side of it is to be able to make it happen, we have to pay some huge cost.
Right. Well, we should also remember the kind of story that comes from the folks that are building this. They're saying, yes, okay, there's going to be these pretty massive short-term costs. We're going to need as much power as you can give us. And we should, as you said, they credibly, you know, they are arguing that they want as much of the power as we can possibly give them, right? So we should be conserving so that we can take that energy and give it to AI. Now, what are we going to get for this besides making, you know, Sam Altman the first trillionaire? We'll do that. But also, we're supposed to get, cures for cancer and end of the climate problem, right? So AI we don't know how it's going to solve the climate problem. We just have this faith that it will.
That it will, right?
Yes. And all it takes is sacrifice the climate, and then we'll fix the climate, right? And this seems
madness to me. I mean, it really does.
It does, right? Yeah, you don't need to be a world-spanning AI brain to figure out that this seems like a bit of a crock.
From the Roots Up is community radio that is sponsored by community businesses. If you'd like to join the growing list of folks who make this show possible, reach out to Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, at khi.com.
How much of this is real? The promise of it is very real. Mm-hmm. And how much of it is just somebody's fiction to drive up their stock price?
Even just in the 90s, there was this idea that if we build computers that are strong enough, we will essentially eliminate aging, we eliminate death, we will eliminate disease, we will eliminate scarcity, right? We will have this, what they would tell me would be this post-scarcity economy, right? Where you just, like Star Trek, right? You want something and you ask the wall for it and it pops out of a slot, right? And so everybody has everything they want at will, right? And they're all healthy. And if they become unhealthy, you can be pretty quickly fixed. So this idea I thought was strange and interesting. And I came to learn that at the time anyway, it was called transhumanism. And it was this idea that if the more we become enmeshed with our computers, the more we have qualities like them, always upgradable. We can always move the contents of our old computer to our new computer, right? Therefore, it just gets better, right? You throw away the
constant state of upgrade. Yeah,
Yeah, it's in a constant state of upgrade. So why not run our bodies that way, right? Why not reuse a body until it's no longer useful, and then take all the contents, all the mental contents out of that, stuff it in a new one, and now you've got another, 60, 70 years to fool around with this new body, right? And that idea, I think, is it's pretty seductive, right? I have to admit that it's something that sign me up. Wow, that sounds great, right? So sure. So that was I think that's really what motivates quite a lot of the top people in this field, is the idea that we are on the verge of becoming a essentially immortal kind of creature that can therefore start colonizing space. You know, there's vast distances. It take us centuries to get to
many lifetimes of any normal human lifespan, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if you and I are going to live for 5,000-6,000 years, then taking a 100-year trip to Alpha Centauri starts to become reasonable, right?
Right. It's that Game Theory song, Nine Lives to Rigel Five. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
I might have to drop that in here.
Yeah, they were part of this this thought process as well, right? They knew people that were thinking this way when they wrote those songs. And so that was the thought, right? But now it's starting to get like real for some people. You know, I think if you're a tech billionaire, it's got to be part of your thought process. Like if you really were Jeff Bezos, you might be thinking, "Holy crap! Like, I will be immortal."
Right. Like, it's no longer
speculative. I see how to do it. Yes, that's right. I've got the cash to do it. And so that would make you really want to push these technologies. The consequences be damned, because the upside is an infinite
immortality.
Yeah. So what would you pay to have an immortal life, right? Wouldn't you pay everything to get there?
Right. The part of that that's very disturbing is that paying everything is pretty much the rest of us.
Right. Right? Like, that's right.
You were
that's
very
right.
careful to say,
"Sorry, Sean, I gotta cut you off so that I can make it to Alpha Centauri."
Yeah.
I will always remember your sacrifice.
Yeah, or not. Probably not.
If it would be ethical, if it is ubiquitous, right? Everybody gets a equal share of this wonderful good that we're creating. If we create a world like that, then that's one that we could justify ethically. But more likely, what really happens is we create what you so rightly called the digital divide, right? It's really more like a digital chasm now. There's a great separation between people of various classes in their ability to now get the kind of education they need to take advantage of this new AI world where, this gold rush that's happening right now, and try to be part of it. So the digital divide is still here, and it exists in America right here, right in the county that you're listening to this radio station from. Just imagine how much more pronounced it is across the globe, right?
Is there an opportunity here to advocate for this being a public good? I mean, is that ship mm-hmm. sailed, right? Like, mm-hmm. You mentioned it's a gold rush. I mean, it sounds like it might be a little late to then for somebody to raise their hand and say, "Hey, by the way, I think that, mm-hmm. all the research, the foundational research and all this and all that data that you gathered, well, that belonged to everybody."
Right.
And this ought to be a public good. Is that too late? Will we pass that?
Yeah. Point? Well, that of course is the right argument. That is where we should have landed with this. Instead, we have allowed some people to become fabulously wealthy off of data. Literally, like what I was trying to say earlier, you did the work, right? All of us fed this machine with all the data that it needed. And Ben, you and I are not getting stock options, you know, right, in these companies. So there is something, deeply unfair about that. Absolutely.
But wait, I don't even have to write my own emails anymore, John. Isn't that enough?
That's right. That's right. That should definitely be worth making somebody a trillionaire over, right?
Side by side, slide by space and time. Yeah, the Neil Armstrong telecast of 1969. Proportion distortion, I saw in those shoes. I learned a kind of ego that I doubt I'll ever lose. It's
we all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
What are the things, you know, folks in our listening audience, A, should really understand and know? And then also, what are things that they can do to sort of become better digital citizens, for lack of a better term, in this in this age we're in and in the age we're headed into? Mm-hmm. Because I, like you said, I don't know that there's a way to stop the way that the direction that it's headed. Mm-hmm. But there's probably a way to make it better.
There definitely is. So there's a couple of ways at it. So one way at it is through various governance structures, right? So I don't think that is impossible at this stage. We can use the democracy that we have to make some really important changes. Many of the people who espouse this technology espouse it because it is, as they claim, you know, the greatest tool for democracy ever created. It's also, unfortunately, the greatest tool for autocracy ever created. If we put all of our negative inclinations into it, that's what it comes up, right? It's going to be Mecha Hitler. If we instead make sure that we are building a machine worth building, then we're going to get something completely different out of it. It's a powerful, wonderful machine. It's just that, do we want to have that, have the benefits of that technology spread widely across our society, or do we want to focus that into a very tiny number of technological elites? And that's up to us, right? That's our decision right here, right now, and we get to make it. It isn't pre-configured. We are going to make that decision this generation. And everybody behind us is going to either benefit or suffer from the decision that we make. So we have a great deal of agency right now, and this is the time to utilize it.
This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue, every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento, or online at torchclub.net.
Well, what haven't we talked about, John, that people, I mean, it's such a broad topic. Like, I've tried to just go where the conversation led us, but, mm-hmm. You know, after we hang up, what's the thing you're going to go, God, I wish I had talked about this?
Yeah, well, I think that the really big change that we're seeing right now is AI and its application in education. So, for instance, here in the in California, we've had the California State University system do this massive AI rollout, so that the idea is that every single one of our students in the system will have full professional access to ChatGPT, always the best version of it, into the future. Right now, our students are a little lost in what this thing is that they've been given and how specifically to use it. So we are here in California making a big bet, a really big bet, on the future of education, when educators themselves are pretty in the dark how to use this thing. So you're going to see this from grade school to college. And I'm hoping, you know, that we can do a good job, but I'm a little worried that we will be letting down our students in certain ways. So I think paying attention, like if I could rewrite the book, I think I would now add, you know, a chapter on AI and education, and what that means as we tell our students, you've got to go to school, and then simultaneously tell them that, oh, by the way, every job is going to be automated. You know, by the time you graduate, there is going to be no jobs for you, but go to school, kid. Have fun.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your book. You said it's headed for a second edition. Tell us about your book and the topics you cover in there.
It's called The Great Philosophical Objections to Artificial Intelligence, The History and Legacy of the AI Wars. That's quite a title, isn't it? The book traces the forms the conversation around five different moments in history where academics and business people kind of had these philosophical arguments about what AI was. Was it even possible? Is it something that we want to pursue or not? And so we call each one of these a different AI war. We're kind of in the ethics war now, where early on people were just kind of arguing whether it was a thing that was even possible. Now we know it's possible, and now we're arguing about what we should do with it. Each one of these wars, that they're academic wars, right? They're conceptual wars, and each one of them was fought to a draw. They have never been fully solved. For instance, one is what, you know, can machines understand what it is they're talking about? Can machines really have meaning, have a concept of meaning the same way you and I do? Is that a permanent disability, right? Is that something that machines will never understand, right? These are the things that we get into in this book, and they're really important, because you'll hear this term artificial general intelligence, AGI, thrown around, like, you know, Elon Musk thinks, you know, we're just weeks away from creating AGI, or that Grok already is an AGI. I've heard that in the news recently. Well, he's going to have solved all five of these philosophical problems in order to achieve that. And so far, there is no good solution for any of these problems. So that's why I'm not worried about the machines taking over, right? But I am worried about crazy people with extremely powerful machines taking over.
Man, John, this has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Again, this is John Sullins, Professor of Philosophy and Computer Science at Sonoma State University. And thanks again for being with us, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Great fun. And it's great being back on the radio with you.
So there you have it. The robot overlords have not yet taken over and enslaved us. And that's great news as far as I can see. And, you know, let's be clear. There is a lot we can do right now to help shape the direction of this powerful technology. The future is not yet written, and it is us who gets to write it if we make it so. As I always like to say at the end of the show, everything is impossible until it's not. I'm Sean Frame, and I hope you'll join me every week as we delve into a topic like this, and I hope you'll engage me in a conversation. If you want to reach out to us, send an email to FromTheRootsUpShow@gmail.com.